As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
The Athletic.
The race is on, and after a frenetic month of launches and testing, finally the F1 2024 season is upon us. But will the Bahrain Grand Prix spring some surprises? And what will be the big storylines for the season? I'm Ed Straw, and joining us to look ahead to what should be a dramatic year are Scott Mitchell-Mal, Ben Anderson, and Mark Hughes. Well, Mark, we'll come to you first. What season number is this for you? I know you said on a recording the other day your first race was 93 Donington, journalistically, but obviously weren't full-time F1 at that stage.
Yeah, no, full-time F1 from 2000. So this is my 25th consecutive season.
Excellent. That's a milestone worthy of celebration. So consider this your celebration moment. Oh, and a round of applause. Excellent. This is what we like to see. Well, I started 8 years later, but I was mid-season in 2008. I started.
You took a Kimi Raikkonen-esque sabbatical as well, didn't you, at one point?
Well, I was sort of part-time on and off while I was in a more factory-based role for a few years. But I prefer being trackside. Let's put it that way. And yeah, Ben, obviously this is about 10 years or more. So yeah, 2014 was your first full F1 season, wasn't it?
Correct. Yeah, so it has been 10 years, but I've been in and out of the paddock. So a mixture of factory and race team roles over the years.
Exactly. You're a little bit too slow to be permanent trackside these days. That's the that's the problem. And Scott Mitchell-Mal, the youngest of our group. So it's all fresh and exciting and new for you, so you're the most excited of us all.
I hang around with you guys and continue to do this podcast precisely because I'm allowed to be described as the youngest somewhere, which is quite pleasant. I'm on a gentleman's seventh season covering Formula One. So when was my first pre-season test back in the Autosport days? Would have been 2015. So in and around F1 since 2015. But full-time since 2018. So yeah, the excitement, it still feels quite fresh. And even though I can't, even in the early years of covering F1 for me with the Hamilton-Mercedes dominance, I don't think we really had to quite battle the sense of dread in quite the same way. And yet even amid all of the expectation for Max Verstappen and Red Bull's success this season, still loads of excitement, loads to be intrigued about and look forward to. This isn't a write-off at all.
Well, there's so much to learn at the start of a new season. So yeah, the first race is always great, whether you're there on the ground covering it or working at the factory as Ben is, or just a fan, just enjoying it, which is the best thing to be, really. You can really, yeah, anything can happen. That's the exciting thing heading into the season, except perhaps Alpine winning. But let's get on with it now then, Mark. We'll start off with a look at the drivers. Judging by testing, Max Verstappen is favourite for fourth consecutive world championship. Can you see anything derailing his serene progress?
Nothing that we've seen so far. It would take a real curveball, I think. You know, some as yet non-evident problem, reliability problem or something like that. But no, it looks very, very controlled and routine so far. It looks as if there's a lot more to come. They're just a pattern of his runs and suspecting they were running a fairly low PU and testing, PU setting and testing, he still had a very handy advantage. So, no, everything looks in place for Max to continue approaching those career stats that are his only realistic target of achievement left.
Yeah, exactly. It's astonishing the numbers he's racking up now, and he's showing no signs of easing off. But Scott, if we agree that the Red Bull RB20 is the car to have, there is one driver who could have a say in the championship fight. Is there any chance the Sergio Perez story changes this year?
I would be surprised. I think there is scope for it to be better than it has been in the last few years. I think Perez's main objective for this season has to be to find a way to connect the start and end of his season last year without that horrible... It's not even a middle, really. It's probably the 70% in between the start and the finish. I do think by the end of the season there was a bit more to show for it. Remember that in the second half of the year, especially final third of the season, that Red Bull was nowhere near as developed through the year as rival teams, so the advantage did shrink to a degree in some places. Max might not have made it look that way at times, but I think there was an extra degree of vulnerability. And even within that, I think Perez kind of got his act together a little bit at the end of the season, but not to the point where he was threatening Max or anything like that, and arguably not 100% doing the job that Red Bull needed him to do, but it was better. And I think if he finds a way to make that more consistent, that's kind of his low point through the year, and that's where his base level is, then at least then that's where his story changes. But I think he'll have his work cut out to win two races again this season. I think there's less chance than ever of Verstappen leaving anything on the table for him.
I think Perez is kind of damned if he does and damned if he doesn't, because if he tries to do again what he did last year, and presuming the Red Bull is a class above and it's effectively a two-driver race for the championship from the start, if he overreaches and tries to go with Max, he just doom spirals again. I don't think it's possible. The way Max is at the moment, how relentless he is and how consistent he is and how good he is, there maybe is a handful of drivers who could go with him in the same car, but I don't think Perez is one of those. So all he can do is kind of what Red Bull has been pushing him to do at the end of last season, what Helmut Marko has explicitly said he should do, which is be the kind of best version of himself as a number two driver, get as close as he can, 2 or 3 tenths off Max, and just try to protect against those emerging threats from behind potentially. But if he does that, and this is something you've talked about many times, Ed, you know, be the best version of yourself, be the best number two you can be effectively, that demoralizes him in terms of what he wants to get out of Formula One as he gets later into his career and achieve the maximum result for himself. So, yeah, if he wants to extend his stay at Red Bull, I think he has to pick option B. If he wants to doom his career quickly, then he has to pick option A, and neither of them looks particularly appealing.
Yeah, I think that's right, Ben. And I think also the idea of him achieving that best version of himself throughout the season, I think probably would carry him into another season, an extension into 25, just because the stars align a little bit better in terms of, you know, I think their real desire would be to have Alex Albon back in that seat. And yeah, in theory, you could, I suppose, buy out his contract with Williams, but, you know, Would they really be that motivated to do that when Max is continuing to win anyway? 26 is probably the easiest fit to get Albon in there. If you're looking who else might go in there, that you know it would be a vacancy there potentially for Carlos Sainz to come back into the Red Bull fold, but again. You know, there was some friction there between the two camps when they were paired at the junior team there. The appeal might be on Red Bull's side, might be more for Albon. So you could, in that scenario, you could quite easily picture Perez, as long as he has a respectable season and, you know, doesn't have that. We've seen a few phases, particularly last season, where he got into some sort of confidence crisis and it just all spiraled downwards. As long as he doesn't have that sort of season, I can quite easily see Checo doing a respectable job, enough to get him a contract extension for another year.
He's the ideal continuity option. He's the continuity option that Red Bull would dearly love to have, because I think they could have a really nice range of options in front of them. I still do think, I know what they're trying to do with the second Red Bull team and make that a serious proposition on its own, despite all their best efforts to make it the opposite of that. And I think in that situation, Daniel Ricciardo being the lead driver there is really, really good for that team and the brands associated to it. But part of me does still think that Red Bull would love nothing more than Ricciardo to blow Tsunoda away this season and then them slot him alongside Verstappen at Red Bull in the senior team, because then it's just the marketability of that and the appeal of that from a commercial point of view. There wouldn't be any of that friction, because it's hard to overstate how much gratitude sort of seeps into Ricciardo's newfound F1 focus. He's not just happy to be there, but there's a huge element of him being very grateful that Red Bull have taken him back into the fold. And I think if he was going to be in Red Bull Racing a couple attempts, three attempts off Verstappen, I think genuinely he would not cause problems in the same way that other drivers might, whether that's Sainz, if the Toro Rosso beef was revived, where we've seen it flare up a couple of times between Perez and Verstappen in different ways. So I don't think that would happen with Ricciardo in the same way. But I think it's a fascinating season from a driver's perspective with regards who goes where and how it influences the driver market, because you've got Perez's form, Ricciardo's form, maybe Yuki Tsunoda, but I just don't think Red Bull takes him seriously. Like, that feeds into the Red Bull debate. You've got what options open up to Carlos Sainz and how appealing does he make himself. You've got Alex Albon looking to see whether or not Williams is a serious prospect and actually worth him wanting to stay at least until the end of his current contract in 25, maybe beyond that. And then there's other sort of subplots within that, or sort of around that from a driver market perspective, which is, you know, does Sauber sort itself out and make that Audi project more interesting longer term? What the hell happens to Alpine? Like, and the drivers there, the, you know, which of the two superstars in F2, Andrea Kimi Antonelli and Ollie Bearman, are they going to make such a great claim in F2 this season that they have to find themselves someone has to find them a seat for 2025? Like, I think we're going into a season that has, from a driver perspective, the most interesting storylines. And I haven't even mentioned there whether Lewis Hamilton's going to find out this weekend whether or not he's made a terrible decision bailing on Mercedes. And if in a few races' time, Ferrari's going to have imploded and he's walking into an absolute hellscape over there. Like, that's another thing that plays out this year. I think it's fascinating. I can't remember a season like it.
Ricciardo's form and how long Red Bull gives him to kind of prove that he's back has quite a big bearing on that remaining driver market domino effect, I think. Something that was kind of looking a bit tame, I think, until Hamilton blew everything up, and now suddenly it's really exciting, and every driver's performance this year, or of those remaining ones who are out of contract, who have a chance of moving, suddenly there's, I think, a heightened interest in how they do and a bit more at play, because Sainz's situation is obviously much more complicated now than he expected. I think Perez is the preferred option. I agree with you, Scott, for Red Bull, just because, you know, if you're talking about one driver who's 2 or 3 tenths off Max versus another who's 2 or 3 tenths off within the fold, it's much of a muchness, and you don't really want to make changes, I don't think, unless you really have to, because it's disruptive. And really, if these cars are locked in, kind of as James Allison was suggesting, till through 25, and everyone's already going to be thinking, you know, at least half an eye 26, that's when Red Bull are going to be really looking to shore themselves up, because that's when they're most at risk of getting tripped up by the regulations or another team making a big step. So they don't need the shield around Verstappen in quite the same way this year and next year as they maybe do beyond that. But how they resolve that Perez situation and then what they do with Ricciardo and where Sainz goes and whether Alonso stays at Aston and who takes the Merck seat and what Bearman and Antonelli doing F2 is going to have a massive impact as well, because finally we have a couple of genuinely exciting young prospects pushing up from underneath. So there's jeopardy there for almost every existing driver in terms of proving that they deserve to stay on the grid.
And it's going to be particularly busy in these early parts of the season because people get an idea of where everything is and then they can start moving. There'll be a fewer hanging fire waiting to see how things play out, including with what happens with the F2 drivers as well. So, yeah, interesting from that perspective. But I guess the big question is, who's going to be the closest challenger to Max Verstappen outside of Red Bull? And ultimately, are they going to be able to do a bit more than they were able to do last year, given we can't see anything derailing Red Bull? Although we should say, obviously, the Christian Horner situation still isn't resolved. We will talk to that once it's resolved and the investigation's complete. But there's still, that's the only uncertainty hanging over Red Bull at the moment. So who is going to be best of the rest, and how good is best of the rest going to be?
Well, I think the massively interesting thing on the driver's side is that Ferrari in any way, shape or form capable of challenging Red Bull on a Sunday? Let's say it's as competitive on a Saturday as it showed it could be last season and even in 2022, it's a given that Charles Leclerc will be fighting for pole positions at several races, if not most races this year. But it's just fascinating. You hear some of the talk about, you know, like the race run and the time management being a different planet to 12 months ago, and the balance that the car has and the way the drivers feel, the confidence they have, it all seems rosy and nicely improved. But I actually think what was weird about the preseason test was I can't remember a time where 18 of the 20 drivers actually sounded quite happy with their cars. The only two that didn't was the Alpine drivers. So we're in a weird position now, I think, in the third year of the rules. Everyone's kind of catching up and dialing out their weaknesses. It's stable this year compared to last year. Even last year, there was those changes, weren't there, to the floor edges, for example, the height, and that there were some subtle differences in how things worked. So it's just total stability, convergence, car characteristics are becoming a little bit more maybe benign, less nasty is a better way to put it. So it's interesting, like how much does 18 drivers can't all be happy by qualifying in Bahrain? So where does that shake out? If that Ferrari's in the mix, then I see no reason why Leclerc won't take it to Verstappen in the way he did at the start of 2022. He's good enough to, he's got the support of the team. There's no question there. The absolute fascinating thing for me is if the Mercs are in the mix, how the hell do they manage that? Because it's one thing to say that it's equal opportunity for both your drivers. But if Lewis Hamilton thinks he's got a sniff at a farewell title for Mercedes or for race victories and the like, he's a phenomenal team player. But he is also a racing driver, and he will be selfish when he needs to be. And he can be selfish knowing that actually long term, it doesn't really matter how selfish he is. So that is an absolutely fascinating dynamic that fits into the who is going to be or who could be Verstappen's nearest rival.
Well, you've got a lame duck driver in both Ferrari and Mercedes. I'm using that in the American presidential sense. Sainz is out of Ferrari and Hamilton's out of Mercedes at the end of the year. That will have an impact.
Yeah, I think the dynamic at Mercedes in particular is the interesting one. Russell's staying there and Hamilton going, and they've proven fairly evenly matched in the two previous seasons. I don't think that Mercedes will really be, other than maybe not having them in on R&D developments and stuff like that, I can't see that Mercedes are going to favour Russell over Hamilton or vice versa. I think they will be very grateful to have that problem. If the car's quick enough, that's when it becomes a problem, and I think they'd rather have that problem than not. I think Hamilton, if he has a sniff of anything, you know, like victories, will go into that mode that Scott was talking about, whereby you have to be selfish and you crack on. And I don't think Mercedes will be able to do much about that. And I think there will be a sort of internal sort of acceptance of that, even if there might be a little bit of disapproval from Toto or whatever. But it's just how it's going to be. That is just how that dynamic is set up. The interesting thing is, if this car is balanced in the way that allows both drivers to drive in the way they naturally want to, do we see Lewis step up, or is that gap that we've seen, George Russell to Lewis Hamilton, the genuine one, and that is the world-class level at which George is operating and always has done. So, you know, there's still a little bit of that question mark. Is George a very good driver, a proven Grand Prix winner, but not a megastar? And is Lewis going to step up this year to a different level of performance? Or is he already operating at that level and so is George?
My feeling is that when you lay all the cards out on the table, Lewis has still just got that little bit of extra all-round skill to his game. I think Russell, on the race stints particularly, is still a little bit rough around the edges, a little bit too hard on the tyres. Maybe he'll fix that this year and it will be much of a muchness. But I'd say going into the season, Lewis allowing also for that little bit of extra depth when the biggest prize is up for grabs, probably just has the edge. You'd probably say him and Alonso, in terms of all-round racecraft, have the capacity to challenge Max if the car allows. And Leclerc definitely on a Saturday and probably on a Sunday if the Ferrari is good enough in race conditions, and it seems to be an improvement. I suppose the other thing that could make this season more exciting as well, to Scott's point about, you know, 18 of 20 drivers being happy after testing and that being almost unprecedented, it feels like the field is condensing overall, and the Red Bull has never been the best qualifying car under this rule set. So if they've continued to bias it more towards the races, others have managed to close that gap but not sacrifice too much qualifying pace to do it. Maybe that's impossible, I don't know. Then you could have a scenario where if the Ferrari's competitive enough on a Saturday, and so is the Mercedes, and so even is the Aston, then, or even the McLaren, then you don't have Max locking in a front row grid slot every time, or a third or a fourth, and just knowing even if he does qualify behind, he's just going to blow past on the Sunday. You have to hope that he qualifies down a bit because Red Bull doesn't get it set up into the right window every time, and then the other cars are good enough in the races that they can hold him off rather than just inevitably be overtaken by him either before or after the first pit stop.
Yeah, the ideal scenario would be, wouldn't it, if the if the Red Bull is, let's accept that the Red Bull is still, you know, 4 or 5 tenths clear on race pace. It would be a fantastic scenario if 5 or 6 cars are actually faster than it in qualifying. And then each race is the challenge, is can Max get past those 6 cars? Because he's in the fastest car, but it's not qualified there. That'd be a lot to wish for, but at least it would set up an interesting dynamic. But yeah, it's just one of many possibilities as we sit here in this moment in time.
Well, the really positive thing is Ferrari, Mercedes, and then McLaren, who we'll get on to shortly, all seem to be kind of in that chasing group. So there's lots of stories there still to track, particularly with the driver market situation as well.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
Hey, Frank, a little birdie told me you don't need a satellite dish to get DirecTV.
What's the little birdie?
Was it Jimmy the Sparrow?
It's a figure of speech. Point is, you can stream DirecTV over the internet now.
Oh, sure. Next you're going to tell me those big birds are made of metal and filled with people, right?
You mean airplanes?
Stream DirecTV without a satellite dish. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Terms and restrictions apply.
Well, we haven't talked about McLaren yet. McLaren obviously are steering clear of the driver market shenanigans, barring something unexpected happening. And as we have seen this year, the unexpected does happen in the driver
market. Lewis Hamilton's going to go there in 2025 as well.
Well, yeah, exactly. Keep on surprising people. But Mark, what comes to you first? And it's obviously there's questions with both McLaren drivers, because the Lando Norris skeptics say, oh, he hasn't won a race yet and he makes too many little qualifying errors. But if that McLaren is as good as it should be, or at least should become as the season progresses, he should be able to get that first win under his belt, shouldn't he? And then how well Oscar Piastri does compared to him probably depends on that tyre management thing that he was working at last year, inevitably for a rookie. So there's a really interesting dynamic there as well, and two drivers with plenty to prove.
Yeah, and I think that perception in some quarters about Norris is misplaced. I think it's just because he's been so close and for reasons outside of his full control, it hasn't worked out for him. And I think it in moments of pressure, particularly pressure from Piastri, actually, because he hasn't achieved that win yet, he pushes beyond what is reasonable or possible. And he'll have the occasional incident or, you know, the crash in Vegas, or he's had a couple of incidents before then when Piastri was doing better. And yeah, that says Piastri is of a caliber high enough to do that, to apply that pressure. But also, I think you would see that trait disappear from Norris once he had the win under his belt. And it goes back to Sochi in 21, really, didn't it, when he'd done that brilliant pole position and had the race won in what was not the fastest car. It was a competitive car, but it wasn't the fastest car. Yet he had that race won. And it was just lack of information, really, from the pit box about the second weather front, which lost him that race. And, you know, it made him make the decision that he did, which lost him the race. So he is fully capable of winning a sequence of Grand Prix and a World Championship. He's one of the elite performers. And for me, there isn't really a serious question about the level of Lando Norris. I think he's a mega driver. Piastri is every bit as quick. Certain types of corner is even quicker in fast corners. As you say, he still hadn't fully worked out the tyre equation, and it is a very tricky equation with these Pirelli tyres and these cars. And he hadn't got it fully worked out by the end of last season, and there were suggestions in testing from his long-run testing that maybe he's still struggling with that. So that's going to be his big challenge. He doesn't really need to worry about his pace. And he's just, the pace of the car will be whatever the pace of the car will be. And in terms of his own career progression, that's just that puzzle that he has to unpick, really, because it will hold him back for as long as he hasn't fully decoded it. But I don't have a serious worry about that. I think he's going to develop into another one of the mega drivers.
Yeah, I'd certainly agree with that. And hopefully McLaren will be up there, because the more cars that are up there, the better. And obviously, Scott, there's lots of things that have happened at McLaren, not just the impressive leap forward last year, but they've got the new wind tunnel up and running now, the new driver and loop simulator. They've bolstered all sorts of things, production capacity, composites, facilities, that sort of thing. So McLaren needs to show it can keep pushing on in order to show that the trajectory it's on is back to being a championship challenging team. And I'd say really it would be a disappointment if McLaren didn't get a win or two in a Grand Prix this year. I think that's fair, isn't it?
I think it is. I don't know whether or not we'll be slightly disappointed with where it starts the season relative to the end of last year, just because having scored so many podiums through last season and talked a good game about carrying its development curve through the winter and using the winter as the opportunity to make some changes to finally rid the car of its most pesky McLaren characteristics. I did get a little bit of a vibe from testing that they haven't made tremendous headway in doing that, whether it was Piastri saying there was still work to do and that they can feel some improvement but not total, and Stella still saying that the MCL 38 is not ideally suited to this track in particular, and this track's got a lot of slow speed corners on it. And you kind of feel like if they'd had the success in turning it into the all-rounder that they want that car to be, they wouldn't be talking about ideally suited to one circuit or another, and it would have been a bit more impressive. We know that I don't feel like they've missed targets in the way that they did last season, but they're also talking about how there's stuff coming, that the development potential they see in the wind tunnel and in simulations clearly very good. So I suspect that is they've got the launch car to a good level. It's just there's more still to come from certain ideas. And there's always a trade-off, isn't there, between when do you turn the taps off in the tunnel or on CFD and actually commit to producing something and getting it on the car? Because the temptation is always to just run it a little bit longer in the wind tunnel, run it a little bit longer, run those extra 10 or 20 CFD calculations and just, because you could just see if we do it for a little bit longer, then it's not just It's not just a relative thing in terms of like, if they do it for this many days, they'll get this much out of it. It could be something where there's a big curve on the horizon and they really want to chase that. So I'm curious to see what they bring to the car and when. I just am a little bit wary of where it'll be at the start. But if that car is, you know, top four, top five among the teams, it's still way better than they've started the last couple of years. And there is always the prospect where if we just come off the back of a week's testing in Barcelona on a high-speed track rewarding downforce, maybe we'd be lauding the McLaren as best of the rest behind Red Bull. You don't know because we've only got the sample set of one, and that'll still be the case this weekend.
Yeah, the Bahrain track specificness is a curveball there. But I'm so kind of going into the winter so excited about McLaren and the momentum they built and then the sounds coming out of there at the start of this year, you know, when they launched their livery before everyone else. And then they were so careful about disguising the car when it actually appeared. And you arrive at testing kind of expecting a big step based on everything they've been saying about the development trajectory and how positive it is. And it, I don't know, everything just felt a little bit underwhelming to me. I expected, I don't know, to see a bit more, also for the vibe from there to be a bit better. And I get that, you know, maybe this is the circuit that most exposes them, but you would think, given that, if they were succeeding on their path, they would be more excited about what they've done on a track like this. And the fact they're not is maybe a little bit worrying. Will the car look different next week? Are they just sitting on a load of stuff they haven't shown yet and it's all just a big game? And then we're wowed by the McLaren we see for practice and the first race. I kind of hope so, because I also feel like last year, they, a bit like Aston Martin too in the early part, they got a bit of a free ride from Ferrari and Mercedes just not being together. And if Ferrari and Mercedes are much more together this year, which appears to be the vibe coming out of testing, then that makes life automatically, to my mind, much more difficult for McLaren and for Aston.
But the fact is that McLaren looked in the mix based on testing. So it's interesting. Andrea Stella made the point that there are innovations on this car. It's just everything's in it's in the millimetres is the way he put it. So it doesn't necessarily need to be big visuals. It can be small things. But yeah, they look like they're thereabouts rather than there at the front, but they've got something to work with. But it's interesting you mentioned Aston Martin there, because Aston Martin's interesting because obviously the driver market makes Alonso's situation very, very interesting. You talked on our Aston Martin launch podcast about some of the messaging Alonso was putting out there about his future. And Aston Martin still feels like it could go either way, because it seems to be kind of pushing up to that group. But if it's the fifth best car, then they're going to be kind of dipping into Q3, sort of Q3 marginals. RB could be pressuring them. So it's really interesting to see how that team ends up going and where Alonso is, because it wouldn't take much of a swing one way or the other to turn it into a very, very good storyline for Aston Martin, or a slightly troubling one.
Yeah, I mean, they made the big step change last year, and the question is whether they're in plateau or whether they've got a similar sort of step change within them. And if they do, then Alonso's probably going to feel quite comfortable staying there rather than looking around to see what other alternatives there may be. But he's obviously going to be keeping a very careful eye on how that Aston compares to the Mercedes and what sort of trajectory each team seems to be on. And he's as I said back in that podcast, he's absolutely plotting a route to a third world championship. That's definitely what is in his head. You read between the lines of what he's saying, that is absolutely, you know, it's in his head that he's got one last shot at it, and it might, you know, it might be a year or two down the line, but he's absolutely ready to commit to that.
Yeah, and that just makes for a bit of a tinderbox. And obviously Aston Martin want to keep him. They know that if they're not delivering at the level he wants them to, and he thinks there's a chance to jump into a superior Mercedes, if it is superior, he'll go for it. And that's what could make it such a delicately balanced first part of the season for that team. But we shouldn't be too negative about Aston Martin, because they're looking pretty good. But even Alonso himself was saying it was not realistic to expect a repeat of last year's early season run of podiums. So it's looking a little bit more bottom of Q3 than pushing up towards the front couple of rows for them. But again, we'll see how it goes in the weekend. But I guess the really interesting wild card, Ben, is RB, isn't it? We've mentioned Daniel Ricciardo. The car looks pretty good. It's not just last year's RB19, as some people say, but it's got lots of RB19 in it. It's got the suspension front and rear, so it's got that great mechanical platform. And I guess it's now time for Daniel Ricciardo to show just how good he is, and potentially for Yuki Tsunoda to upset the apple cart by continuing to do what he was doing the back end of last year and actually fundamentally being quicker than Ricciardo.
Yeah, there's a danger of the two of them kind of cancelling each other out a bit, isn't there? It's like with Ricciardo takes a step and smashes Tsunoda, people will say, well, it's only Yuki Tsunoda that he's beaten. It doesn't tell you anything. And if Tsunoda beats Ricciardo in the inverse, people will say, oh, but it's Ricciardo, he's washed up now. Didn't you see what he did at McLaren? So there's a kind of a situation where neither of them wins, potentially. In terms of the team, I guess we got a preview of this towards the end of last year. You know, they had developed quite aggressively. The car got quite quick. It was troubling Q3 and the point scorers by the last race, and they looked like they had the ability to leave the back group of teams behind, maybe, and testing seems to have continued that pattern, with the proviso that obviously you don't know how light they were running, so that maybe skews how close they are to that gaggle of teams behind Red Bull, Ferrari. Does look like they've got something in hand over the other teams in the lower midfield, but then with the exception of Haas, those teams have changed their cars quite dramatically over the winter. So you would feel like instinctively RB maybe needs to cash in early on while it potentially has a baked in advantage. And then once Williams understands its, you know, risky direction a bit better and the Sauber comes together a bit more because they've changed so much, those teams should be more of a threat from behind. But it's a good starting point for that team. It's just a shame that even they can't explain what it's called properly.
It's interesting, actually, that pattern in the field, because we sort of got this notional three groups. There's kind of a Red Bull and then the Chasers, and then you've got sort of the midfield that's sort of a bit RBE and maybe Aston's in there, and could anyone push up out of the back group? Then you've got the back group, but it could almost be, Mark...
Oh, Alpine too. I didn't mention Alpine, did I? They're in that back group in terms of big concept change.
Yeah, exactly.
But, they've been so underwhelming, I forgot about them.
Well, precisely, yeah. But it does look a little bit, Mark, like, and again, Bahrain's very difficult to judge. The times tend to be more condensed here than at some tracks. But there's the possibility we kind of end up almost with more two groups rather than a really distinct midfield. It's like there's a front bit and a back bit. And then even then, the back bit might be pushing up quite well against the front bit, which is good for unpredictability, because then a few tenths here and there makes a difference between Q1 and Q3.
Yeah, I think you might see the pattern change from circuit to circuit a little bit, but it did look as if, like, the back of the Chasers group, say McLaren Aston, did have a comfortable 2 or 3 tenths in hand over the lead of the other group on race on low fuel pace was RB, and on race pace was Williams. It did look like that, but again, that could easily be changed this weekend, even on the same circuit, as everybody's got their heads around what they found in testing and have reacted accordingly. But it will then, you know, we'll see when we get to a bit more of a variety of circuits, probably after 4 or 5 races. But yeah, to me, it does look like there is still a gap in between the Chasers of Red Bull and the upper midfield, let's say.
And Scott, in that back group, which teams or drivers are exciting you storyline-wise? Are you excited about the prospect of Alpine?
Well, I think it is quite fascinating in terms of how they deal with it. I think they have a driver lineup that could quite easily combust in that kind of situation. I mean, the Netflix episode is writing itself at the moment, where there's this disastrous start to the season, the car's uncompetitive, they're struggling to get out of Q1. And in the first couple of races, when everyone sort of really needs a boost and they need to be picked up out of it, they have a needless collision with each other fighting over 16th. I feel just like it does feel a little bit like that. I think there's nothing interests me about the the Sauber drivers or the Haas drivers. I don't really... I mean, I'd be interested to see if we've...
Valtteri Bottas' sympathy corner moment straight away. Sympathy for Valtteri.
Or Valtteri Bottas' celebration corner. I'm curious to see how often we get to visit that either of those through the season. Obviously, that's a given. But just in terms of there's nothing about their sort of career stories or anything like that. Like nothing... There's a little bit of jeopardy and like Joe's got to get himself, like work out whether or not he's going to be able to extend his F1 career. Kevin Magnussen needs to work out if he's going to be able to convince Haas. But I just think...
And Joe's talked about wanting to be really attacking this year. In fact, that was an interview that ran on our Sauber Launch podcast. So yeah. he's determined to be a bit more thrusting this year.
Yeah, so there's some stuff. Like, but what I'm saying is like none of it really grabs me. I think it is the... Because it's tied to much bigger stuff. It's Albon at Williams and how that team looks. Can it deliver on the progress that he needs to see through this year to give him the confidence that it's going to work longer term? And how Albon performs within that, and also sort of what support he has. Is it going to be Alex Albon finishing seventh in the Constructors' Championship again, or is it going to be more of a Williams team push this year?
I think going back to the Alpine thing, it's almost a worse situation for Ocon than it is for Gasly, isn't it? Because if I understand it right, Gasly at least has an option to stay for 25, so he can better afford for this year to be a little bit of a throwaway if they're resetting their direction and trying to get things on track again. Whereas Ocon, you know, just at the time he needs to put himself in the shop window when there's a lot at stake, he can't really afford for the car to be reversing towards Q1.
Yeah, no, I'm not sure Ocon is a great shout for the Mercedes seat at this stage. He's been linked to it, but I think that's based more on old ties. I mean they looked at him obviously very closely. They knew what he was doing inside out, and I think they thought he wasn't really much of a step forward on, say, Bottas at the time. So I think their eyes are on other things. So yeah, that is difficult. But it's strange, Alpine, because they managed expectations massively. They said, oh, we're going to have a slow start, we're going to struggle. But the size of team they are, a slow start really is almost being where they were last year.
Yeah. But
they've kind of beaten down our expectations so much that when they're in the back group, we rank them ninth in Rank the Teams. You can make a case that they're 10th, given that the car doesn't look good on track. It doesn't look quick. It looks a bit draggy. It's overweight.
Other than that, it's perfect.
Yeah, the car upgrade's coming, but so's everyone. So I'm a little bit worried about Alpine. There's things I like about it insofar as I think it's positive that Bruno Famman's talking about not stupid targets, but that keep making everything better. That element of it's good, but that does have to have an effect. And the big question for me is it really yielding gains behind the scenes? Because the race team track side's doing pretty reasonably at the moment, but I'm not sure they're being given the best machinery. So that's the big question. Can they develop that car? But it's hard to see Alpine doing better than sixth last year. And even now, right now, sixth looks a bit of a long shot. So yeah, that's going to be, that's a storyline that could turn into quite a big one. What is going on here? What have F1's worked teams struggling? Could be a fairly big deal. So that's a good thing. Ultimately, there's stories throughout the field, and we don't really know who's going to be the lead challenger to Verstappen. There's lots of drivers there who are very motivated, very good, capable of winning races given the chance. And there's excitement pretty much even in the really minor drivers, if I may call them that. So that's positive for the season ahead of us. We'll get back to the pod in a moment, but first, a word about our partner, Grammarly. No matter what kind of work you do, how you communicate is key. All those emails, reports, and presentations are equally important to the collaboration needed to get things done, and Grammarly can help. Grammarly is your AI writing partner to help you communicate more effectively and efficiently so you can make a bigger impact at work. I know from experience that Grammarly can help you save time on any writing task and ensure you feel confident about what you've produced. In fact, 96% of Grammarly's users report that Grammarly helps them craft more impactful writing, and their tone suggestions can help you navigate even the most difficult work conversations. Make a bigger impact at work with Grammarly. Sign up and download for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's grammarly.com/podcast. Easier said, done.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The 7-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
Right, a few other things it's worth talking about. Scott, amid the launches, there was that quiet announcement about the change in the sprint format, which we knew roughly was happening. Sprints are in China, Miami, Austria, the USA, Qatar and Brazil, so still just six. Can you explain the new format?
Yeah, well, first of all, it's worth revisiting where we ended up last year, which was at your favourite version of the sprint, wasn't it, with the sprint Saturday?
Just terrible. It made Saturday feel so utterly disconnected and pointless. I don't know. I just don't get it. And it was always going to lead to that. So, yeah, it was almost... I had very low expectations of it and almost managed to fail to even meet them. It's like Alpine.
The best bit about this is that I actually didn't need to throw it back to last year to explain the new format. I just wanted to wind it up. he bit quite nicely. So we're moving away from the... What did they try and badge it as? Was it Sprint Saturday? They tried to call it, because we would have the practice session on Friday, qualifying for the Grand Prix Friday afternoon, sprint stuff on the Saturday, and then the Grand Prix on the Sunday. But that changes now. So we're going to try and have a bit better flow through the weekend rather than disconnecting qualifying and the Grand Prix. So please, someone interject if I have remembered this incorrectly, but we will now have the practice session on the Friday, and then after that we have the sprint shootout, so the qualifying session for the sprint race. Saturday, I'm going to say morning, but it won't be the morning in all of it. But the first Saturday on track session will be the sprint race. And then in the afternoon, or the later session on the Saturday, competitive session, we'll be qualifying for the Grand Prix, and then the Grand Prix on the Sunday. And within that, we have different Parc Fermé rules as well, which is, I think it's going to make the Grand Prix weekend more interesting now on the sprint weekend, because everything's not locked in and same old from what you saw in the sprint to the Grand Prix. So there'll now be one Parc Fermé effectively governing the sprint portion of the weekend, so the sprint shootout, and then it's what you have in the sprint shootout you have to run in the sprint race on the Saturday, but then Parc Fermé resets for qualifying and the Grand Prix. So I quite like that. I do sincerely believe this is a much better sprint format than last year. I want to see it in action and see what it throws up, both in terms of those positive potential spins from that, but also the unintended consequences, to determine whether I think it's better than the original sprint format, which set the grid for the Grand Prix on Sunday.
Yeah, it's definitely an improvement from last year. But Mark, what do you make of it? Do you think this is going to make the sprint format really work and really fly?
To be honest, no. I think the sprint will just remain a side interest thing. And I think you can tweak it as much as you want, and it's not really going to, you know, make that transition to a major sort of focus. But it's not supposed to be, is it? It's there as a value-added thing. And within the Grand Prix weekend, the Grand Prix is obviously always going to be the big thing we get excited about, and anything which is on the side of that needs to not detract from that. So I think it can, therefore the sprint's potential it has a ceiling. And I think, I prefer this way of mixing it up. I didn't I didn't like the disconnected element of Saturday. It just felt like, you know, that this is one day that's got nothing to do with the rest of the Grand Prix weekend. At least this now feels once more like it's all part of the same event.
And it's actually one of the few significant changes this year, that there's everything else is just detail changes. The rules are, to all intents and purposes, the same. The DRS is enabled after one lap in the race and one lap of safety cars rather than two. That's a small detail change, nothing transformative there. But how about the off-track stories, Ben? Obviously, the earlier caveat, we can't really get into the Red Bull Horner situation until that's resolved. We will talk about it when it is. But there's a lot going on in the background as well, isn't there, with Andretti and FIA, FOM, the political side. We've already talked about the driver market. It was quite quiet in testing off track, but there's a lot of things bubbling under.
Yeah, the FOM, FIA, as Mark describes it, turf war, I think will roll on and on, won't it? There's no love lost there. The Andretti situation is completely tied up in that, in terms of one side deciding we're going to do this unilaterally, and the other side going, well, no, we're going to kibosh that because you didn't involve us in the process from the outset. Be good to see that resolved amicably, but I don't think it will be, and it will run and run. The driver market situation, as we've discussed already, just exploded by Lewis Hamilton. He completely blew up our predictions that we tried to do in January on one episode of this podcast. So Scott Mitchell's 100.
Speak for yourself. I said that Carlos Sainz wouldn't be at Ferrari next season. So.
Yeah, you were half right.
I was right for the wrong reasons.
that's going to be massive now, because you know that huge bombshell move has a huge dramatic domino effect across the rest of the grid. And what else is going off track? Oh yeah, the Horner stuff. What I mean, yeah, we can't say too much at this stage. We wait for it to be resolved, hopefully soon. There's, I guess, the potential for that to be the biggest destabilizing effect on Red Bull if Horner suddenly exits the team, and that creates its own domino effect internally. But you feel like the position they've got themselves to in under these rules and with this car, providing, you know, there isn't some unforeseen thing they've tripped up over with their radical new design for this year, that kind of locks in performance for them for this year and next year. So in the short term, they're kind of protected in terms of the product they've got for on track. And it's, I guess, only if the team at the factory doing the development and or the race team executing at the circuit is destabilized by a certain outcome in the Horner situation to an extent that then, you know, benefits the rival teams.
We should say that on the Horner stuff, as we're recording it now, there's no resolution, there's no public announcement. But because of what you were saying, Ben, like the pressure that just has been growing, the suggestion of a more imminent resolution has kind of crept out, hasn't it? There was a point a week or two ago where we were expecting the sort of start of the season to probably come and go before it was resolved. And now there's talk of it being resolved and being announced publicly before the Bahrain Grand Prix weekend really gets going. So we'll be looking out for that. But on the off chance we are Fernando Alonso summer 2022 over this, I felt the need to add a caveat there just in case at some point after we finish recording we actually get the some kind of communications drop in our inbox.
Yeah, there's no definitive prediction made here by you, though. There's also, Mark, the thorny question of the 2026 regulations. We've got the engine regulations. They've been around for a while. The chassis regulations, still a lot of back and forth on that. They want to have the complete draft out there and published somewhere in the middle of the year. But there's still a bit of uncertainty around a lot of factors of that, aren't there? So that's something that's going to be rumbling on in the early months, I suspect. And we may hear a little bit of lobbying going on in public if people are finding things they don't like are getting close to being in those regs.
Oh yeah, I mean the lobbying will already be going on. You know, I think as the regulations are being firmed up. So in broad brush, the aero will be quite similar to what we've already got, and following the same aim of making the cars more raceable and keeping the wake as clean as possible. But there will be implications upon, you know, chassis design of the different format of the engines. So it's not as fundamental a change in the chassis regulations as 2022 was, but I think the effects may be just as serious and just as difficult to adapt to, and have the potential there to really change the competitive hierarchy. So yeah, I think there's probably a lot still to be fought over there, and I'm sure that teams that feel that their strengths and weaknesses relative to the others will be campaigning pretty hard to have things aligned the way they would like them.
Yeah, I'm interested to see where they get all the weight savings they want to from, because they need to take a chunk off, and it's going to be pretty tricky to achieve that, unfortunately, with these cars. They will get a bit lighter, but yeah, I'm not sure whether it's going to be a dramatic transformation that everybody's hoping for. And of course, there's also going to be the unexpected, isn't there? There's a lot of topics that we know are bouncing around. Obviously, the whole AB teams thing that Zach Brown's banging the drum on is another one that's rumbling on. But there's always things that come to pass and that surprise as the season progresses. And yeah, we're going to be talking about that all year. But just to finish off, predictions I know we hate, but we're going to have a go anyway. So does anybody want to predict anything other than Max Verstappen and Red Bull Constructors' Championship and Drivers' Championship win? Should we take that as a given? Anyone going to dissent?
Constructors' Championship, I think it's possible. I think if Ferrari or Mercedes have massively upped the game to the point where they're consistently scoring big points each weekend and Red Bull isn't totally in the distance, I think there's absolutely potential there for Perez to be the weak link at Red Bull, because I think Ferrari's driver lineup or Mercedes' driver lineup is absolutely exceptional. At this stage, am I brave enough to pick one of those teams? Probably not. But I would say that if either of Ferrari or Mercedes establish themselves as best of the rest this season, I think that team will beat Red Bull to the Constructors' Championship.
It's possible.
Oh, I think that's too bold. I think one of them will get closer this year.
It'll be boring then.
Yeah, well, I'd love to say, you know, either one wins the World Championship for Constructors and Verstappen is dethroned as Drivers' Championship just for variety, but I just don't think it's going to happen. You know, the advantage he had last year, he could have won the Constructors' Championship on his own. I don't think necessarily he'll be able to do that this year, but he might. And you would expect, I would expect Perez not to be the majority 2023 version of himself. I think he'll be, if he's sensible, he'll be more consistent and will just do a better job and won't necessarily, like Scott said, he won't necessarily win two races or have any particularly stunning peaks, but I'd expect a kind of better baseline of performance, and that will be enough to see Red Bull across the line in both, even if Mercedes and Ferrari particularly, as expected, are stronger.
Yeah, that's certainly the most likely thing, isn't it? Yeah, but it depends. If it's a bit closer than expected, then the second driver can be the weak link. Max Verstappen can only score as many points as are available to one driver.
Yeah, I don't see any threat for either championship, really, to Red Bull and Verstappen. But I do, and then maybe I'm being optimistic here, but I do think that of those three, four teams behind, Mercedes, Ferrari, McLaren, Aston, I would say there's a good chance at least three of those four teams are going to get a race win or two. That would be my optimistic take on it. I do think there's reason to believe that, given that the gains Ferrari and Mercedes in particular should have made by abandoning concepts which were dead ends, relative to the gains that Red Bull have made, by the looks of things, hopefully it's enough. The relative gains is hopefully enough to sort of swing it enough times that we do get a little bit of variation in who's winning the races. But in terms of who's racking up the points, no, I don't see any change.
Yeah, I think that's a reasonable prediction. But there's always the possibility, and Scott's scenario is an interesting one. But I guess that means the main prediction is who's going to be the best of the rest in terms of Drivers' Championship and Constructors' Championship. Does anybody want to pick a horse in that particular fight? It's very, very difficult, I would say. Ben's going.
Yeah, I'm going to go for Leclerc as best of the rest. I think there's a good chance that Verstappen actually whitewashes the season in terms of winning every race. And the Ferrari, by virtue of becoming more benign and more consistent, loses some of those peaks from last year, like Vegas or Singapore or Monza. And Leclerc scores more points, more podiums, doesn't win a race, but finishes second in the championship. I can see that happening.
I'd be surprised if Verstappen and Red Bull can win all the races, but it's always possible. I'm not sure that car will have quite the superiority in the races, but as it did last year, but it's always possible. Anybody wants to send? I must admit, Leclerc and Ferrari would have been my pick as well. Scott and Mark, do you want to stick your neck out? I know there's so little to go on. So.
I mean, I'm going to pick it based on what I kind of want to see, purely because I just think it creates the most interesting stories through the season, and say it's Lewis Hamilton at Mercedes, because if that's the case, then it means that Mercedes has really got its act together and should be quite a competitive prospect, which just race by race could create interesting storylines. But if it is Lewis, then it means that we've just witnessed a really fun, potentially quite awkward season where, as you described it earlier, Ed, the lame duck driver has led the charge through the year, which I just think will be quite amusing to watch play out.
How about you, Mark? Are you going to throw in a Nico Hülkenberg or something to really surprise everyone?
He's really excited by Alpine.
Yeah, well, I have to go McLaren then, don't I? It's not difficult to make a case for McLaren being best of the rest. They were by the second half of last year. They're definitely not in that position in the Bahrain test, but as we've talked about, it's probably not a circuit which suits the traits of the car. And maybe they're just further along understanding their car than Mercedes and Ferrari are of their very new concept. So, yeah, they've got a fantastic driver lineup. Yeah, why not? Okay, I'll go McLaren.
Excellent. I think that probably illustrates the fact that second group chasing McLaren looks very tight and it's hard to pick. We could end up with it just fluctuating by race weekend. But ultimately, it does look like Red Bull and Verstappen are in a great position. And although we talk about wanting to see more people up there fighting them, we shouldn't overlook the fact that if that does happen again, Verstappen is a phenomenal driver and it's a privilege to see what he's doing because he's just absolutely astonishing. The performances and the consistent excellence he delivers. And the same with Red Bull as well, that maybe has raised the game again with its car. So we don't want it to go across if we're wishing Red Bull any ill, because they're going to be phenomenal. They're going to be favourites, whatever happens. So at worst, it's just another chapter in that incredible legacy that Verstappen and Red Bull are building.
And no one picked Aston or Alonso. So that means that Alonso's going to leave, right? And put himself into one of those other teams we've picked out as being best of the rest this year.
Or wins the first two races.
Now, that would be a dramatic storyline. But that's the thing. There's so much that can happen. It's still to be written this season. And testing was inconclusive, as it always is. So I'm quite excited. Scott, you're looking like you're about to raise a provocative point.
No, just I agree with you. I was just making use of the fact that we're in the same place. And I was showing you some actual human reaction rather than these goobers through the screen.
He was looking at you admiringly, Ed.
Wow. No, I wouldn't go that far.
He spends a lot of time doing that, so that's to be expected. You can't blame him. Still, we hope that's given you a bit of a feel for what is to come this season. Thanks to Ben, Mark and Scott. Obviously, we'll be all across the season, all the way through. We'll have our usual post-race podcasts. Anytime there's some news breaking, we'll be gathering with our microphones to talk through the ramifications and the detail. And remember, we've got plenty of other podcasts to listen to. Our IndyCar MotoGP podcast. Obviously, MotoGP is getting going as well, so that's well worth listening to. We're now going to get into the 2024 F1 season proper, so stay with us for everything you need to know from the Bahrain Grand Prix.
The Athletic.